Hello, and welcome to another edition of Critical Q&A, the show where I answer your questions based on what you have left me in the comment section of my Q&A videos or have sent to me by email at askchrisshelton@gmail.com. If you have any questions for me, just send them to me at that email, and I will put them in my question queue. I wanted to reiterate a couple quick announcements about things here on the channel, and if you don't care about any of that, go ahead and skip ahead to the first question. But I thought you guys should get this update. I talked about this on Friday night. I have been starting about 3 months ago. I started doing a Critical Cult News show, a live show every week, and I am putting that on hold. I'm putting that on hiatus right now because it is consuming way too much of my time, and I have not been able to get to the other projects that I was moving forward on at Great Guns up until I decided to pull the trigger on the news show, because I like to overwhelm myself, apparently, and so that's what I did. And I did not make any progress on those other longer-term projects that I've been meaning to complete and that I was completing. And so rather than continue to, as they say in Scientology, cope and organize, which is not at all working, I'm going to dump that and get back to getting those videos done. There's, you know, I know it's kind of the long running joke on my channel that these videos have not been completed, and I get it. I totally get it. But for me, it's a real monkey on my back, and I really do want to get it done. So that's how that's going to happen. And then when I finish that, then I will bring back my Critical Cult News when I can do it in a format that is, that I'm happy with and that, doesn't cut into or take away from getting other projects done that I have had on the back burner. So that is that news. And then the other thing I wanted to let you guys know is you don't necessarily see a lot of changes right now, but there are changes all over the place here in my studio. And it has been a much, it's been made cleaner and more organized. And it's a really, it's a lot different of a picture here. And I have all of you to thank for that. Certainly those of you who have been supporting the channel and helping me with upgrading my studio space with new equipment and tech to make it easier for me to do what I'm doing. Everything is now here on this desk. It's not half over there and half over here. The lights are better. I've got more stuff coming, and I continue to need your help to continue to upgrade this. So if you find my content interesting, informative, and entertaining, and I really hope you do, then I hope you will help me upgrade this by contributing to my ideal org wish list, not ideal org, ideal studio wish list that I've put together on Amazon. It's a bunch of equipment I'm trying to get so that I can do a better job here. And you can help me with that either by getting me stuff off the wish list or helping me through donations through PayPal, Venmo, Buy Me a Coffee, Patreon, etc. There are links to all of these things in the description section to this video and every video I publish. So try to make it as easy as I can to help me out here, and I hope you will do so. That all being said, let's get on with your questions now. Nick, in the United States, many big name universities raise money from alumni. Some of it comes in during the alumni's lifetimes, but a sizable chunk is derived from universities being written into the alumni's wills. There are sizable tax benefits to doing it this way, too. Does Scientology have a similar practice, or is David Miscavige more concerned with taking money from people while they are still alive? All right, Nick, thank you very much for this. And actually, David Miscavige is not just concerned with taking money from people while they're still alive, but in the here and now, right now, 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 go, go, go. It needs to come in now. And if you get that view of Scientology, which I have been stating from day one, that it is a frantic, emergency-ridden call center-like neuroses that goes on there. It's all about the immediacy of the products. And products being, you know, money in the door, course completions, auditing completions, all of that. It's all about what's happening right now. And if you're not working on it to get it done this week, then nobody really cares that much about what you're talking about. And this is at all levels of Scientology. So future planning and the idea of putting something there for the future is written into the policies and talked about and given lip service, but it's not how Scientology is actually run as an organization. And so no, there is no effort on anybody's part to take people's money from, you know, to get them to write Scientology into their will. It, you know, it's possible in this world of all possible possibilities that somebody has done that at some point and willed Scientology some money. But that's not a standard practice in Scientology because nobody's even thinking that way. It's really quite something, and it's a little hard to believe because Scientology has continued to operate on a kind of organizational inertia for decades now. You know, there really hasn't been anything really very new or exciting in the world of Scientology, except these little tidbits, these little bits and pieces that Miscavige can cobble together and throw out, you know, as chum to the public and get them to buy at the various events. And that has been sort of this pattern of Scientology for years and years now. But Miscavige does not and cannot seem to think in terms of long-term planning and executing long-term planning successfully. They might, again, give lip service to long-term planning, but they never pull it off. Scientology is one of the most inefficient, unorganized activities that you'd really ever have anything to do with because of that constant need for now, now, now production. This is the this is that frantic Thursday to Thursday, every week counts, every hour of every day counts to that week ending, right? The coming up Thursday at 2. And after that, that's next week. We'll deal with that then, you know? And this even goes all the way up to the top. You know, this kind of organizational management style, you could say, serves a lot of functions for predatory people, people, you know, manipulative abusers who want to keep people in a frantic emergency fight or flight kind of state of mind all the time. So it's no accident that this is how Scientology is run. Hubbard made it this way. Miscavige continued it and has driven it in further and further and further into the ground because it's not a management style or operating, you know, pattern that has any legs, that has any future to it. It's just constantly consuming current resources and currently available resources and not planning for future creation of new resources, like new recruits, new materials coming in, things like that. They really give this the barest possible amount of work. When they do it, when they do manage to do some future planning and organize something to create for the future, it takes a great deal of time, a great deal of effort, a lot of heartache and pain, and a lot of people suffer in the process in order for them to put something permanent there. Like, for example, I'm thinking about the Bridge Publications facility. It's this massive building. Really, I mean, it's huge. And it's beautiful, it's clean, it's a very well-tuned machine that took at least 2 straight years to establish and get trained people in there, Sea Org members, all Sea Org members, operating these printing presses and color presses and lamination machines and all the other things that were required to create a production line to create perfect books, right? Books that are just really good quality books. And Scientology did do that. So it's not that they're incapable of this, but only through a great amount of blood, sweat, and tears is it pulled off. And again, even then, that's a relatively short-term thing compared to lifetime planning when you're talking about alumni and wills and things, right? And let me give you another example of something that I'm talking about here that was just something that happened. I don't think anybody really even barely remembers this. I remember watching it happen. And it's very, it's a great example of what I'm talking about, okay? In the early 2000s, there was a program put together to a subscription plan for a particular set of books that were being published. L. Ron Hubbard gave a lot of lectures, right? Like thousands and thousands of lectures, and not all of them have been released. all of these lectures exist. One assumes that most of them at this point have been transcribed and, you know, have been put through sound filtering and all that kind of thing. And some lectures are not capable of being restored in an audio format, but they could still transcribe them. They, you know, somebody could still sit there and dissect and translate Hubbard's drivel into a transcript and, well, here's a lecture, right? And a lot of the early lectures, I mean, the materials are so, you know, poorly cared for over the years that that some of those lectures are just never going to be released on audio. But the solution to that was this particular set of books. And these were large, encyclopedia size, hardbound, very nicely printed, very glossy paper, very beautiful layout. These were the R&D volumes, the research and discovery volumes, and they produced about 14 or 15 of them, if I remember right. And they were a chronological publication of all of L. Ron Hubbard's lectures from June 1950, when he was lecturing out of his house and giving auditing demonstrations, all the way through to, you know, the 70s or whatever, whenever Hubbard gave his last public lectures. Obviously, the confidential stuff and the high-level staff-only, Sea Org-only stuff would not be reproduced in the R&D volumes, but all the public-level stuff would be, everything. And wouldn't that be something, right, to finally have all the lectures published in a body of work that would be these R&D volumes. There were, it was estimated there would be like 100, 115 of these things or something, right? There was going to be a lot of them. And the bright idea, some bright spark came up with this idea, which was actually a legit good idea from an organizational standpoint, which was, let's set up a production line where we can pull these, we can produce a new R&D volume every 2 months or something. I think it was every 2 months. And that would not necessarily be, once you got the whole thing going and set up template-wise and all of that, right, as far as you're, you know, repeating work that would happen with every single R&D volume, because they all look the same, they have the same gold lettering, the same style page, work and all that, right? Like it wouldn't, and they're really, at the end of the day, they're just tape transcripts. They're just, that's all they are, right? With some historical notes and some photographs thrown in for color. So these would not be really hard books to compile and publish, right? One could conceivably see that one could come out every 2 months or so. And you go, yeah, I take about a month, plan it all, typeset it, put it all together, and then a month to, you know, get the whole thing produced and distributed, and we have ourselves a new R&D volume every 2 months. Not only that, but we're going to sign people up. We're going to pay for it. This whole program will even pay for itself plus by getting people to sign up for it on a subscription plan where all they have to do is give us their name and a credit card number, and every 2 months we will debit it and we will get them a new R&D volume mailed to their house. And this was a standardized subscription program, nothing special. You could administer it with a spreadsheet if you really needed to. I mean, one guy could do that. Bunch of names, all the volumes the people have, dates that they were sent. I mean, you know, easy peasy. So not even any kind of real super logistical nightmare to do this. And they already had produced 14 or 15 of them. They knew what it took to produce. They saw, you know, that this could be done. Okay. This was promoted and people started signing up for this and they were really excited about it. And the idea that all of the lectures were eventually going to come out in, you know, a matter of years, wow, this is going to be amazing, right? It was really blowing some people's minds and they were really, really happy about this and they couldn't give the church money fast enough. Well, the whole thing lasted for about 2 or 3 months. And then it was just gone. It was gone. There was no more subscription plan. There were no more R&D volumes coming. And as far as I know, the Church of Scientology has not produced a new R&D volume in over 20 years. The whole thing was just dropped. And that's kind of how Scientology operates, you see. That's an example of what I'm, you know, of what I'm trying to point out here is there is no future thinking in Scientology. They are an entirely, you know, I use the word neurotic, and I'm only kind of using that to sort of throw in here this sort of like fixation on the present at the cost or expense of the past and the future, right? They're stuck on now and they can't think into the future, even though one of the classic mantras of Scientology staff from the whole birthday game thing is think in futures, right? Think big, think in futures. Those are the staff mantras. And they're supposed to calculate their quotas and draw out these graphs every year. Every single staff member does this and then draw plans for what they're going to do to produce these quotas and hit these marks so that a year from now, they are 5 times better production-wise than they are now. If they're producing 10 now, in a year from now, they're going to organize things so they're going to be producing 50 of it, whatever it is, books sold, students completed, PCs audited, whatever. But it never happens, does it, right? They never manage this kind of expansion. This is the reason why, right? It's not that Scientologists are a bunch of stupid idiots, but they are organized by a stupid idiot and they are run like they are stupid idiots. And you treat people like they're stupid idiots long enough and they'll start acting like stupid idiots. And that's Scientology staff in a nutshell. I don't even mean to demean them. I just said they're not stupid people, but they act that way because of this organizational structure and this demand for constant now production, right? To the point that if you're sitting around planning for the future and some executive comes along and goes, hey, what are you doing right now? Well, I'm planning things out. You're wasting your goddamn time. Knock it off. Go work. Get to production. Let's go. Right? That would be the response you would receive to even trying to do some planning. Right? And this is all, of course, good news because Scientology is a destructive cult and we don't want them organized well or operating efficiently. You know, and they don't. They don't at all. It's a joke, Scientology's level of production and their misutilization of their staff. Oh, it's a mess of confusion and chaos in Scientology. So it's a great question, Nick, because it really highlighted this whole thing for me to talk about here about how disorganized and confused they are. You just wouldn't believe it. I mean, you really wouldn't. If you were to go into any Sea Org installation and just sit and be a fly on the wall, you would be shocked at how much wasted time, wasted effort. And over time, you can only start to imagine this must be purposeful. This is being run this way on purpose. Because you think to yourself, nobody could be so stupid as to continue to run an outfit this badly with so little getting done. And yet, that's the situation, right? A bunch of well-intentioned people who are indoctrinated with such junk that they would rather rip into each other and tear each other apart than work together to produce something. That's Scientology staff. And that is certainly Scientology Sea Org. It's a mess. So thanks for giving me this time to this question to prompt me to talk about all this because I never got to talk about some of that stuff. So there you go. Stefan, what is your thought on why Miscavige is living such a lavish lifestyle compared to L. Ron Hubbard? Scientology expanded a lot in the 1960s to 80s, and Hubbard had money, but now with these ideal fraud orgs and the IAS whales, it seems like Miscavige is over the top. A pair of his shoes could buy pizza for all SO staff for 2 years straight. I have no doubt LRH enjoyed great meals and had the best cameras, but even when on the run, he had a little ranch or a trailer or stayed in cheap motels. It's almost like LRH never wanted to be found, whereas DM says, here I am, look at me, and can do no wrong. Well, you're absolutely right. David Miscavige is very much in the mode of look at me, while at the same time, hiding, right? He cannot be seen in public or go out in public venues or ever have a night on the town or anything like that without having to go in, you know, full cloak and dagger mode or go in full, you know, drug lord mode with SUVs of bodyguards following him around and things like that. His life is not his own, and he has no one else but himself to thank for that. And he likes to play at the lavish, you know, sort of even playboy type kind of lifestyle, all paid for by the Church of Scientology and its parishioners, and all, you know, through tax-exempt monies, all of it. So it's pretty sick, right? It's pretty sad what people can get away with, and David Miscavige gets away with all of it. And it's, of course, by design. He wants it that way. Those are kind of the only real pleasures he gets out of life, I suppose. But Hubbard was not unlavish himself, right? I mean, you definitely are correct that he traveled around in a motorhome, but it was a very nice motorhome. Let's take a look at that. It was this big Bluebird luxury motorhome. And Hubbard didn't really want for anything in terms of physical needs, but his relationships and his emotions and his mental state were so poor, and he was so, especially over the last years of his life, I'd say the last 15 years of his life, let's say, were on the run and hiding and paranoid and, you know, in a place where he couldn't live high on the hog and be the, you know, the big man on town, around town or whatever, even though he wanted to be, and he used to live that kind of lifestyle when he could, but you know, he was crazy. He was really losing his mind over the last many years of his life. So, but again, yes, he had all the nice cameras and all the nice stuff. So, but he wasn't a Miscavige. See, Miscavige is not hiding from the law, right? Miscavige is hiding from process servers, sure, but he's not like, you know, he's not wanted the same way Hubbard was. And so he wants to be the Tom Cruise-esque, you know, public figure and be regaled and regarded as the, you know, as the big cheese top dog kind of guy. And that's, I think, a lot of overcompensation for, you know, his ego issues and his personal, you know, his inner hatred of himself. So I think that's, you know, that explains an awful lot of that. As far as why he lives the lavish lifestyle, right? It's because he doesn't want for anything. And as far as Miscavige is concerned, that's the pinnacle of existence, right? It certainly isn't. Miscavige certainly isn't the guy who takes a great deal of satisfaction and is really fulfilled by helping other people or by servicing other people or by seeing that people are taken care of. He's the opposite, right? Everything is about him. So to that degree, that's why he lives the lifestyle that he lives. And that's about as much as I could, you know, sort of conjecture in that direction. So I don't know. There you go. Anon, do you have any thoughts about the body shaming of David Miscavige over his height by some people on YouTube? I get the joke and how he's insecure about his height, but it leaves a bad taste in the mouth for me. I've always thought cult leaders should be shamed for their behaviors and abuses rather than their body. It also occurs to me that DM will probably never hear such comments in his isolated bubble, but anyone watching who is also insecure about their height or whatever will. There's a risk of becoming an abuser whilst trying to stop abuse. What do you think? Well, I absolutely think that you're right, that ridicule and humor can be taken too far and that it can become offensive, and that every single person has their own lines in the sand as to what they find offensive or not based on their own psychological triggers and condition, right? So I get that. Totally, totally get that. And you're not wrong that there are, you know, people insecure about their physical characteristics, and when we make fun of Miscavige or other Scientology luminaries like L. Ron Hubbard and their physical physical appearance, and, you know, their bad teeth and their weight and their height and this and that, that it comes off badly, right? Totally get that. And you're absolutely right that the target of Scientology criticism is not David Miscavige or L. Ron Hubbard's personal physical appearance. It is their abuses and their and the system that they run, that they set up or that they run and control, that does serially abuse people. That is the target. The dark comedy and black humor that is found in this is often, I want to say, just as much about catharsis and healing as it is about trying to find humor at the expense of other people. You know, when you are someone who is abused and ridiculed and treated poorly for years and years, it's only human and only natural that you want to get back at the target of your, you know, of your abuse, that the person who abused you, your abuser, is someone you want to get back at. And you can't go punch David Miscavige in the nose, but you can call him names, ha ha ha, right? And you can release some tension and release some like emotion and feel some satisfaction in getting back at that guy for all the bullshit he did to you. It's kind of this, you know, tit for tat, back and forth kind of thing. So one can see why human beings will do that, lacking the ability to actually go confront their abuser, and we lack that ability in the Scientology world. I can't go drive up to where David Miscavige is and go confront him. He hides. He's a coward. He's a cowardly man. And I could describe his physical characteristics and build up, you know, his Napoleon complex or whatever, you know, and we can get into all that. But it's frustrating. It's very frustrating from this side of the microphone to have a target that you cannot engage with. I really wish Scientologists and cult members in general were not cowards, but they are. Almost uniformly across the boards, they are. They will not engage because they know that when challenged, they do not always have the answers to what they are challenged on. They learn this through experience. And so they go, oh man, I can't deal with that, or I don't want to deal with that, or it's interpolative, and they'll throw down a number of thought-stopping cliches to shut down their thinking about, you know, the non-cult members so that they can, you know, and they get plenty of agreement from the other cult members about how they shouldn't be engaging with those wogs, and they'll come up with all kinds of negative and ridiculing terms for us in the process, right? So it's, again, it's a tit for tat, back and forth, standard human behavior. Now, I say all of that not to justify or make right the fact that people say offensive things. I'm explaining why they do it and what it has to do with their psychology and with their trauma. Now, that all being said, it doesn't mean that that's the only outlet you can use. You don't have to call people names or ridicule their physical characteristics in order to experience some healing and some growth and be able to move on. So there are other ways to do it, but we all have our temperaments and we all have things that, you know, that we find individually funny, and things that we take pleasure from. And, you know, giving to Scientology as much as you're getting, you know, could be considered by some people its own form of entertainment or fun for them as ex-members. And you see that, right? You definitely see that. I don't know that I do it a lot. I know I engage in that sometimes. I know other YouTubers spend an awful lot of time doing that. And I think that there's a point where you kind of go, okay, this is too much. We all, again, have our lines in the sand of what we find acceptable and not. And generally speaking, I would, I'd say that if, you know, given a choice, I think we should be focusing more on, as you said in the question, we should be focusing more on the abusive behavior and the problems and issues and damage that these groups do, rather than necessarily focusing on laughing and joking about, you know, what awful, horrible people Scientologists are, and ha ha ha, let's laugh at Miscavige and how short he is, and ha ha ha, and all of that, right? I mean, it's, again, it's a way of getting back, but you're right, he's not going to hear it. And the people who are in Scientology and OSA who hear this stuff, you know, have a bad taste in their mouth when they hear it. But, you know, I ceased caring about what Scientologists think about us critics many, many years ago, because we're not trying to stage an intervention by doing the videos that we do, right? And that's generally what it's going to take to get most of those people out. So you try to plant seeds, you try to give information that can be received by Scientologists or cult members in a way that they'll hear it, or at least that you can plant some seeds. And, you know, maybe this works and maybe it doesn't. Certainly that style of criticism of joking, laughing, degrading, all that will not be well received and won't be very good at planting seeds. But that's not what it's for. Right. So I hope all of this kind of explains the whole thing. We weren't necessarily asking for an explanation of it, but I thought, you know, I'd give it. But at the end of my answer here, I generally agree with you that that it can go too far. Right. I'm not going to ever say we can't do that or it shouldn't ever be done, because that would actually and factually get in the way of some people's healing process. And if we're really being honest, right, it's mostly harmless fun. I mean, words are not, you know, especially words directed toward David Miscavige's height and things like that. These are not, you know, the most offensive things you could possibly be doing with your life, all things considered, right? You want to see some offensive, truly offensive stuff, universally offensive, go hang out on 4chan for a while, right? Or 8chan or something. I mean, the stuff people get up to on the internet is horrifying. So I think that, all things considered, this is a rather light grade criticism, right? Compared to, you know, other things. But there you go. DJT. Is it possible that to declare a person a suppressive person is a violation of their civil rights? As we all know, the First Amendment protects speech, religion, press, assembly, and the right to petition the government. By declaring someone suppressed and removing their family from them, technically, they've interfered in a family's right to be a family. Of course, the church would say that the remaining family are free to go with the SP, but they know that in doing so, they'll be forcing the family to choose between alienation from their own religion, beliefs, and friends, or stay and forever lose contact with a wife, child, or husband, etc. Article 12 of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights states, "No one shall be subjected to arbitrary interference with his privacy, family, home, or correspondence, nor to attacks upon his honor and reputation. Everyone has the right to the protection of the law against such interference or attacks." All right. Thanks for asking me this question. And I could go really deep, really fast into law and human rights and the United Nations and the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and the difference between that and civil rights and legal rights that one is accorded through their country and their national laws. The Universal Declaration of Human Rights does not have the same status as civil rights or laws. It is it's a document that a bunch of countries have agreed is a really good idea, and they endorse the idea of human rights, but very few countries actually establish laws that put all of those rights into codified justice and, you know, that kind of into the justice framework. And that's because it's very, very, very hard to figure out how to do that without trampling on other rights that we have too. These things cross one another in very interesting ways. And from a legal standpoint, it can be really difficult. And let me give you an example, right? Because here you bring up the point, and not an illegitimate point, but not one I necessarily agree with, that violating or that declaring somebody a suppressive person is tantamount to violating their civil rights. Because think about this for a second. Right? Let me just present an opposing point of view for you to think about, and we'll just kind of leave it at this sort of, let's think about this. Any group from the dawn of time, any group of individuals who have gotten together to align around a common purpose or goal, or, you know, social construct like a town or village or nation or whatever, any group must have the right to kick one of its members out if that member is somehow destructive to or disordering or destroying the group. The group must have that right of banishment or shunning, not necessarily killing, although that's often been the solution. We don't like you. We don't want you around. Chop his head off. Well, okay, maybe we don't do that, right? Maybe we just kick you out. We don't want you around anymore. We're not saying you don't have a right to live. We're just saying you don't have a right to live with us because we don't want you around. You are bothersome, annoying, troublesome, somehow messing things up for us. You're not contributing to the overall picture. You're distracting from it. And so, you know, maybe you're even a predator. Maybe you're somebody who's preying on the members of this group in a sexual, financial, physical way. And we don't want that, right? We want you gone. So that right must exist. And it's going to, whether you want it to or not, right? Any group of people are going to eject individuals that they don't get along with and who are not being part of the group with its rules, guidelines, regulations, etc. Every group has them, and this is how groups are. That all being said, right, a suppressive person declare is Scientology's version of kicking somebody out because they no longer agree with or are going along with what that group, as represented by its authorities, its justice framework, if you will, that part of Scientology gets to say who stays and who goes. Now, you and I, from our moral foundations, from our perspective, either outside the group or, you know, on the fringes of the group or whatever, can look at what Scientology does to its members and we can go, well, that's wrong. That doesn't make any sense. That's arbitrary. Sure enough. Just like every other group operates on completely arbitrary, completely made up rules. They just make them up. You know, there's not a lot of natural law behind a lot of the ideas and regulations of groups, the uniforming of groups, the conduct of groups, the etiquette of groups, right? This is all formed by the group. Some groups are loosey-goosey. Some groups are very rigid. Right? They have different flavors and different preferences. Sometimes within the same group, you'll even have subgroups that operate, you know, at different levels of this. But every single one of them does have the right to go, hey, you know what? You're not, nope, mm-mm. And everybody in the group, the majority, in other words, right, have the right to go, nope, this minority, they're out of here. So does it violate somebody's civil rights to declare them and kick them out of the Church of Scientology? No, not really. I don't think so. I think the answer to the question is no. Because what right do you have to stay in a group that doesn't want you? That has in fact gone through a process, a formalized process, to kick you out? Well, I get to stay because my civil rights, right? This is the clash of the civil of the individual's rights versus the group's rights. And this is a complicated thing. I'm reducing this to gross simplicities right now. You know, this is hours of discussion breaking all this down in terms of the individual's rights and the group's rights. And so I'm not trying or pretending to present a complete analysis of each side. I just thought I'd kind of try to make this an answer for my show here today by pointing out what I think to be one of the biggest barriers to the logic of your question is, yeah, but the group has rights too. So yes, the individual does have rights all the way up until they're impugning other people's rights. And the group itself, as a group, has its own set of rights. So that clash of that is something that you might want to consider, or at least I consider, when I think about answering this question, right? Certainly, people shouldn't be subjected to arbitrary interference with their privacy or their family or their home or their correspondence. But when they join a group and they find out that this group gives itself the right to declare someone suppressive and that under these conditions, we will do this, and then the person continues to be part of the group knowing that's a possibility, Well, they're kind of saying, okay, well, I'm okay with this happening, you know, kind of all the way up until it happens to them, right? And then suddenly it's a different picture. And it's interesting how humans are that way, aren't they? You know, it's a little short-sighted of people. But there is a point there where they become aware of that and they keep being a group member anyway. Maybe because they have the misbegotten idea it's never going to happen to them. Or maybe because they are okay with the fact that people do get kicked out of groups all the time. And that makes sense, you know, all the way up until the circumstances of why they're getting kicked out don't make sense, even though the church had the right to do that the entire time, right? And they actually watch that happen with other people and don't question that. So, you know, so there's levels to this and convolutions to this is all I'm trying to say. I'm not saying that they're right for getting kicked out or getting declared or that the Church of Scientology has the moral high ground. I'm not in any way suggesting. I really hope this isn't coming across like I think Scientology has the moral high ground here. From my set of moral foundations, this is Scientology's off the rails for what they do. But as a group, do they have the right to, you know, exclude people from membership? You bet they do. And they practice that right. And when it messes up families and messes up lives, we look at that and go, well, that's not very fair. That's not very right. You know, from a more objective or different perspective, it's not right. Scientology doesn't think so, right? That group of people are absolutely convinced it's right. So, you know, complication. So anyway, bottom line is DJT, I don't necessarily see it as a violation of somebody's civil rights to be declared suppressive. I see it differently. I see it through a different lens. I wouldn't frame it that way, right? It's wrong for lots of reasons to declare and shun people for the arbitrary reasons that Scientology does it. But I'd never really thought about it or at least not right now as I think about it. I'm not thinking about it as a rights issue as such. So anyway, thanks for asking me this question, though. And I'm more than happy to consider any counter responses to what I'm saying right now, because I could be out to lunch here, and I'm more than happy to be corrected on it if I am, right? This is a topic I'm more than happy to learn more about. So feel free to respond in the comments if you think I'm coming at this from the wrong angle. All right. Kashisan, is binging on true crime a cult behavior? No, it's not. I don't think binging on anything is a cult behavior as such. Cult behavior implies a lot more being brought into the mix than just an obsession or over-enthusiastic interest in something. Okay, that's not, you know, that's kind of a different definition of cult. Like when we talk about cult classics or cult films or stuff like that, right? You know, that's a kind of a different concept than the destructive cult behavior we talk about on this channel. And no, I can't see it that way. What I see in people who get obsessed with or binge on either cult material or true crime material, because cult stories are kind of a subgenre of the true crime genre in terms of entertainment. Podcasts and movies and shows and stuff kind of focus on cult exposure the same way true crime is sort of exposed. And people who obsess on that or get really deep into that could just be interested in it for entertainment value. And if so, I don't know, you know, it's not what I'm interested in it for, but at least they're interested. You know, I'll take that. Hopefully that interest turns into something more than entertainment or rubbernecking, and hopefully it turns into some form of activism where the person actually gets active doing something about the problems we're talking about with cults. One hopes that that is, you know, in the future, but I wouldn't call it cult behavior, no. Michael Yoder, in a lecture to auditors, 1958, LRH mentioned something called a bracket, which is a term I haven't heard. What is a bracket and how does it apply to auditing? All right, Michael, we will make you an auditor yet. So brackets are an older term for what became the concept of flows in Scientology. In Scientology auditing, one of the ways that processes are put together or formulated is on around the concept of these four brackets or four flows. It started with three, and then it you know, grew to four. And the way it works is it has to do with who's involved in a thing and how they're and how you're perceiving them. And let me clarify, right? Flow zero is you doing the thing, whatever the action is, to yourself. And I'll clarify. I'll give you an example in a second. But first, I got to walk through the flows, right? So flow zero is you to yourself. Flow one is you to another. You're doing something to someone else. Flow two is somebody else doing it to you. And flow three is some other dude doing the action to another person that you're observing. You're not part of the action. You're observing the action. The action could be stealing something, hurting something, killing something, something like that. So if you were going to put a process together with all four flows, you would have four different questions or commands that you'd be giving to the pre-clear for each flow, would have its own command. For example, let's say you wanted to deal with or process or audit somebody on the subject of stealing. Very broad. Okay, so you might ask on a flow one basis, was there a time or can you recall a time when you stole an apple from, you know, someone else, right? And from someone else is implied in the question, right? Can you recall a time you stole an apple? Obviously, you're stealing it from somebody else. That's flow one. Can you recall a time or recall a time when someone else, Joe, stole an apple from you? Can you recall a time someone stole an apple from you? Would be a flow two question. Can you recall a time or recall a time when others stole from others? Someone stole from someone else, right? Joe stole from Nancy. Any of these would be flow three. Others stealing from others. Can you recall a time or recall a time when you stole from yourself? Possible. And, you know, in the, all the possible possibilities of all possibilities, it's possible you could steal from yourself. And maybe there's some trauma or charge or, you know, whatever connected with this. And so this might be something that you would take up in an auditing session. All of these questions would be checked on an E-meter, right? If the needle on the dial doesn't respond to the question, you're not going to run it. So the way to check if stealing or theft or whatever of an apple is a charged item for a person might be to put them on an E-meter, put them in an auditing session, and then ask on the E-meter, you know, have you ever stolen an apple? Doink, right? The needle responds. Aha. Okay, let's talk about this time you stole an apple, right? Or maybe it doesn't respond. There's no response whatsoever. You know, have you ever stolen an apple? Yeah, nah, it's all good. All right, can you, has Joe stolen an apple? Has anyone ever stolen an apple from you? Doink. Ah, you're upset about, you know, some time that somebody stole something from you. They stole that apple. Let's now run that. Tell me about that. Blah, 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 right? And anyway, and so on through flow three and flow zero. And these used to be, when they were first invented, these were called brackets. Now they're called flows. Same concept, same idea. And there you go. All right, everybody, that is our show for this week. Thank you very much for coming around and listening to me blabber on about all of this. I hope my answers were interesting, informative, and educational, as always. And I hope that you will maybe take some time to support the show, support the channel, help me with what I am doing. I am, after all, entirely fan-funded. And thank you very much for coming around and watching me. I really appreciate it. I appreciate your viewership. I appreciate your support. I'll see you guys next week. Bye-bye.